And what Lewis used to do with them, and I'm sure he still does now because he's very switched on in all that sort of thing, in his first session at the track, he'll do what's called a granny lap and a hooligan lap. Basically, you drive one lap trying to be as smooth as anything, you know, and then another lap, braking as late as you can, turning in, getting the tail out a bit, getting on the throttle. And then they look at the data afterwards and actually find out these three corners, the hooligan lap, was actually better, and at the rest, the granny. So then you start getting an idea on the best way to drive, never mind doing anything with the car. And that's something anyone can try.
Welcome to the Your Data Driven Podcast. If you like this podcast, be sure to visit our website at yourdatadriven.com for more useful help and advice on setting up your race car, mastering data analysis, and driving faster. Welcome to episode 49. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Ace Engineer Gavin Pinkerton-Jones. As an F2 team owner, several F1, Indy and sports car aces have passed through his care. Having raced himself on a tiny budget in the 1980s, he shares several tips and practical suggestions that you can apply to your own motorsports. There's absolute gold dust in this one. So without further ado, sit back, grab a pen, grab a coffee, and let's hear what Gavin has to say. Welcome, Gavin.
Thanks, Mayor. Good to be here.
Look, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us on the show. You have a fascinating background in motorsport and photography, which we could talk about as well if you want. Yeah. You've had several drivers who are very well known pass through your hands, and you've raced yourself as well as, you know, competing at all levels of motorsport, from club karting to Formula 2, Le Mans, and everything in between. Yeah. And the goal today, or the challenge for our conversation, I think, as with all of my guests, is just to really, we can work towards one or two takeaways that you've picked up over your time and experience in racing, that we can take away and think, oh, actually, you know, that's a new way of approaching something, or that's a really common thing that I see done all the time, and you just think, with this small tweak, maybe people could get more out of their motorsport, fun, and go a bit quicker. So how does that sound?
A challenge? I mean, there are a few things you can do that don't really cost anything at all, you know, that can help make you go quicker, or make the car feel better, or make the balance better. So there's a few little things that you can do that on the face of it, they don't sound like too much, but can make quite a big difference to how the car feels.
This is exactly what we're after. Brilliant. Well, before we get into that, then, so give us a bit of background on yourself and your racing, and then we can sort of weave in some of these tips and and tricks, as it were, as we go along.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So I suppose I was born into a racing background. My father raced a little bit, and then he ran a small Formula 2 team in the 1960s, sort of mid-60s, 66, 67, 68, that sort of period, called Shardlow Motor Racing, where he did pay drivers, and that was his life. He drove around Europe on in a VW with a car on the back, as a lot of people did in those days. And, you know, they were competing against Team Works, Lotus, Brabham, all those people, all the F1 drivers of the day that also did F2. But in those days, he made a living like that, with the start money and a little bit of prize money, but really most of the start money. You could make a living. That's how we paid for our family, if you like. There was no sponsorship really in those days. So you went and did a deal with each circuit owner at what they'd pay you to make the start with what driver you had. And that's what made them disappear for 6 weeks and then come back. So I was sort of a bit used to that. Then he got into something else. He bought a dilapidated stately home, which sounds very grand in the Midlands, but it had been stood for 30 years, so it was full of dry rot. It was just a wreck. Yeah. but it had been his big dream to have this thing. So he sold the house we're in and bought the stately home for the same price that he sold the house we're in Derbyshire. So that he sort of got out of motor racing at that point because he obviously had to make that work. And just as I was growing and getting older, we still went to the British Grand Prix and the races. I did a trip with him to Monza when I was 10. Because my godfather was Tim Parnell, that was a team manager at BRM, and he asked us to take a V16 BRM on the back of a trailer, a VW camper, to Milan to go on show during the Italian Grand Prix week. So in 1972, I went with him for 3 weeks. We had a BRM mechanic with us to help with the driving and dropped this car off. And then I was hanging around with, you know, Jean-Pierre Beltoise, Peter Gethin, and the old garages at Monza. And I have to admit, every time I go back to Monza now, those old garages are still there because there's no pit garages as such. You had to push the car around. And I have a little twinkle in my eye when I remember when I was 10-year-old, all the crazy Italians, I was passing them my pass so they could get in the gates and things.
Do you think that's where your sort of passion for motorsport came? I mean,
It's one of those
sports, and it's certainly my sport.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things you can't shake it off.
No, no, it's hard to want it gets under your skin. And yeah, definitely. As a naive schoolboy, I wanted to be a Formula One driver, like most of us, I suppose. And at the time, it probably frustrated my mother quite a lot because she was being the sensible one, saying, "Well, you know, think about an education, though." And I just wanted, at that time, you couldn't start kart racing until you were 14. And then the moment I was 14, they made it 12. So I'd already, I lost. I nagged my dad about doing kart racing. And he said, "Look, I know nothing about kart racing. And I've also got this new thing we're trying to get going. So I'll get you a kart. And obviously, I'll take you to some local club races. But I can't have time to prepare it or anything." And it was good for me because as a 14-year-old, you've suddenly got this two-stroke machine that you've got to learn how to prepare quickly without really knowing. So obviously I made loads of mistakes, you know, not tightening things up and all things like that. But it makes you learn about preparation. So after a couple of years, when I really moved into the seniors, I started to get a real good handle on what preparation meant and why it was good.
What if you didn't have to rely on paddock folklore anymore? Get ahead of the curve. My weekly motorsports wisdom on driving, data, and setup that you can read in just 5 minutes, completely free. Join thousands of dedicated racing and track drivers getting one article every Thursday. If you're enjoying this podcast, then Ahead of the Curve is for you. Subscribers are the very first to know about new episodes. Get deeper discussions, expert interviews, and behind-the-scenes racing stories. Head over to yourdatadriven.com and sign up for free today. Ahead of the Curve, where racing knowledge meets your inbox. And remember, you can also subscribe to the Your Data Driven podcast on any of your favorite podcast platforms. How would you define that then now? I mean, obviously you're looking back maybe with a rose-tinted glasses a little bit, but.
I think just it starts off with something simple like a cart, cleaning it with getting a rag and some polish and some WD-40. So cleaning everything really well, but at the same time as you're cleaning it, that means you're looking at everything in good detail. So you've seen is that grub screw holding the axle in? Has that come out, or is there a crack in that brake disc? But by the physical act of just going in there and cleaning something, you're actually looking, you know, using your other senses to look at everything else that could be wrong with it, and then making sure all the nuts and bolts are tight and a proper spanner check, learning which ones have come loose more than others, and again on a cart, the chain tension is very important. The track width of the front and the rear, making sure that's good and the hubs are tight. And then obviously the engine in those days was just a little two-stroke 100cc engine, but, you know, take the head off, look at the plug, squirt a bit of oil, get a little bit of two-stroke oil. You take the barrel off and put it down the hole in the TT port so it goes to the main bearings, and all little things like that that gradually you learn, and it makes you better over the course of a... I mean, the first race I did, I didn't know there was three heats and a final. I did the three heats, obviously, as a novice, starting at the back everywhere, and I finished all the races. I was quite happy with that. I was ready to pack up after the third heat, and someone said, no, there's a final. I thought, oh, I didn't know that. I was half packed up now. So I was very naive.
That's wonderful.
But it got better and better, and I started doing the British sort of championships at the time, which were sponsored by a magazine called Carton Supercart. So it was Carton Supercart series. And again, that was another level again. I was getting where I could win club races and decent club races. But then you move to that level and there was 150 carts, I think, in 100 national the class was. And it's like, oh, wow, you know, here we go again. So there was a lot to learn there. But again, just I didn't appreciate new tyres and things like that because at that time there was no restriction on tyres. And I'd see some of the top drivers turning up with a little trailer just full of tyres, brand new tyres. So again, it was another learning experience. But then you go back to a club race and you realise you've already elevated yourself quite a lot just by that experience, really.
Yeah, I think the experience of having just trying different things and also putting yourself in a different competition environment.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
it just develops you as a driver. Yeah. It develops you as an engineer. In this case.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you can get very happy in your own little pool, but if you push on and try the next bigger pool along, it makes you, forces you to do things better from your preparation and your driving and everything else. You know, you have to do a lot better just to sort of tread water at a higher level. So it is always good to do that. And most of preparation, really, on a kart or a car, whatever, but it sounds stupid, but spend a little bit more time on when you're setting the car up. To some people, setting the car up means checking the tyres aren't flat and then loading it on the trailer. But you know, get the ride heights exactly right. Get the tracking correct. Make sure it's... I mean, I've known people say, yeah, it's got 2 mil toe out on the toe in on the rear, and then you look at them, measure it, and one wheel's got 1 mil toe out, and the other one's got 1 mil toe in. So. So basically, get the wheels pointing in the right direction, get the ride heights correct and the tyre pressures where they need to be, and make sure all those basic things, that they are very basic, but that's where a good balanced car builds from, really, the basics, before you start messing about with roll bars and things like that.
I think that's great advice. And people say, you know, they get the basics right.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't always tell you what the basics are. So you're kind of like, I'll focus on getting the basics right, but I'm still not quite sure what that means. But, you know, we'll work it out as we go along. But
I mean, each car's got its own different basics that are right. But on let's say, a track day type of car, they're basically quite simple things, so it'll have a ride height that where it runs nicely at. I mean, another little trick you can do, obviously people won't have damper potentiometers and things like that like we have in professional racing, but if you've got corners, like if you're doing a track day at, say, Snetterton, you've got Coram, for instance, that's really high loaded up on the left rear. Do you know if it's in the bump rubber or not on the left rear damper? And it might suddenly snap into an oversteer, and it's because it's had a big load input into the tyre through the bump rubber. And a way you can check your damper movements is a very simple way. Get a tyre rack and put it around the damper rod, and then go and do a couple of sort of normal laps, let's say, not trying to break the lap record, and then come in and see where those tire apps have moved to. And it might surprise you how close you are to the bump rubber on some. And you get an idea then, do I need to open a pack of gap or and all things like that cost very little to do, but can have quite a big effect.
So you're saying, so if there's a, you've got the damper and then you put like a tire up around and then basically as you go round, it's going to kind of nudge it up.
Exactly, yeah. So you put it at the bottom and then as it's going, you come back in and stop, and there'll be a, I don't know, a 20 mil gap then from the shoulder. So you know that you've moved 20 mil. And if it's a lot more than that, the tire up might be stuffed into the bump rubber. and you know that, you've got an issue that needs sorting out, really. Either a different bump rubber to put on or just a bigger gap.
So we should have jumped ahead a little bit, but that's absolutely fine. I just like to do these things as naturally as we can, but I'd love to go back to some of your history in a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it does elevate a little bit above karting. But from a damper point of view, that's a subject that I was going to ask you about, so we might as well talk about it now.
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about that, because they do have a mystique around them.
Yeah,
in the sense of
people would say black art, even, which I don't like.
Black art, yeah. I would actually sometimes say people, and I, in fairness, you know, when I first started, I was guilty of this as well. People confusing the role of a damper and a spring, and how what does making it stiffer. When you're talking about it. Yeah, all these different things in high speed and low speed. Now, I think dumpers is a bit of your a specialist subject for you. So, so what makes a good damper? What makes a good damper versus another one?
This was the question that made me want to try and apply some logic to it, if you like, rather than, like you say, these guys walking around the paddock with some special shiny dampers that you just put on and try. But
because they're really expensive, right? So they're just you've got dampers for like not a lot of money, and then you've got the same thing, same looking thing, for 10 or even more times more money, and you're wondering, like, what, other than the brand name?
Yeah, yeah.
Why is this thing going to be any better?
Yeah, some dampers the more expensive ones will have more intricate internals, but at the end of the day, it's a force. A damper is basically an energy converter, really. It's converting kinetic energy everything moving about into thermal energy. It converts it into heat by squashing fluid through various orifices and shims and things like that. So that's put it in its very simple terms. But that there are people who have misconceptions if you get into four-way adjustable, where you've got high speed and low speed, that people, which I suppose is quite natural if you don't know, think, well, high speed's for the fast corners then and low speed's for the low speed corners. But actually, it's the speed of the shaft, how fast the shaft's moving. And most racing cars or track day cars, anything, spend a lot more of the time in the low speed region. So that's one you'll feel quite a lot more, and generally that'll be around 50 millimeters a second, something like that, up to 50 millimeters a second. And then you've got a mid range, and then the high speed really for things like curb strikes or nasty bumps, where the force is, if it just went up linear and then it goes under a very fast bump, it can put some shocks into the tire and it feels uncomfortable. Whereas if it can just blow off at those higher places, which you can adjust with a high speed adjuster, again, that can make it better. But I would say most track day cars probably haven't got high and low speed. So some have, perhaps on bump and then low speed rebound.
So the people listening, we've got a range really of, we've got people who do a track day, and then which means different things in different parts of the world. Actually,
some are more like own test days, really, aren't they? Yeah.
Yes. Then we've got test days, and we've got a lot of people who race. We've got a lot of engineers who listen in as well. So there's a whole range of people who'll be nodding or either scratching their heads at the moment. And so, it's kind of a tricky subject, dampers, because there's this mystique around it. It's like, okay, so I understand how they work now. You mentioned the word tires. So I've got a tire course these days, and it's basically what we talk about. Tires all the time. I can't believe how much. What a little rabbit hole that one is.
But
dampers is another one. Is another one. Obviously, they interact with each other, but it's a case of like, well, what makes a good damper curve for my car?
There's a mathematical model you can do, and you'll find it online now. I mean, it's in the Millikan book as well, Millikan, where you take the spring you've got on the car, the motion ratio, the weight, the on-sprung weight, and a few other factors, and you can put that in and find out a damper force value in newtons or whatever you want per millimeter a second, and that's how you can get a basic idea of the what damping at let's say a low to medium speed that car requires, and that will get you well in the ballpark for a start. And then obviously for each circuit it's a little bit of tweaking can be done, but that gets you in the ballpark. The more aero you've got on the car, then sometimes damp grip, mechanical grip from the damping is sacrificed a little bit to basically going stiffer to control the platform of the car if it's very peaky on the front splitter or whatever you've got. You might have to run it a bit stiffer for mechanical reasons, but actually you get a bigger gain overall because the aero is working better. So again, you'd only try that by testing really, but certainly if you've got dampers with more than just low speed adjusters, then start with the low speed. That you probably feel those the most to have an effect on performance. And you can try big, we used to call it broad brushstroke moves first. Just go do a run with them all at full stiff and then all at full soft, whatever they are for that damper. And you'll start feeling then where that makes a difference.
And I think that's a really good point. And it's something that, as again, we talk about on the tires, but it's talked about with any kind of approach to testing. And I think one of the things I was going to ask you about was planning, and you mentioned it a couple of times, but it's not being afraid to change something and not being able to change something in a quite big way away from a typical value that you may have, and in the sense of just to explore it. Now, I am an engineer, but I race and drive as well, but I'm an average engineer and I'm an all right driver, but the point being is that I was always wondering, like I knew theoretically on my computer there was a difference, right? I'd done the maths, but I was like, would I as a non-professional driver notice any difference whatsoever? And I was surprised that sometimes, more often than not actually, that you do notice, you can feel the differences, it's really encouraging in a way.
I mean, generally, if you make a change like that, even if you're perhaps not driving the car at its 100% capability, if the change you've made in the right direction makes the car feel a bit more balanced, let's say, then as a driver, you can push a little bit more to use, try and find where that limit is of the grip. So it can make a difference. I mean, when we first started doing GP2, just jumping massively forward from...
I was going to say, just dropping GP2. We've gone from karting to GP2, everyone. Just flagging them. Which, for anyone listening who doesn't know what GP2 is, that was Formula 2, F2, before it was current name. So we've gone full circle, actually, from your dad's...
I know. It was actually quite... I had a little moment when they renamed GP2 F2, which it always should have been F2 to start with, but there was contractual issues, I think. So the first race we did when it was renamed F2, I think, was Bahrain 2018, I think it was. Might have been 2017, I can't remember. But I was working with Virtuosi with a Russian time with Artem Malkov then, and he actually won the first race. And I thought, yeah, I met my dad, who unfortunately is no longer with us, that I thought he'd be very proud of the fact that we it was just running left to him, we won the first ever race.
Oh, it'd be absolutely, you'd be like, right, now you need to buy an old house and do it up. That's what, that's all he'd have said. It'd be like, right, you've achieved everything you need to in racer racing now. Go build, go renovate something.
Yeah.
So how do you get there? So right, come on, let's talk about that, because I think this is a fascinating story and I only know a little bit and I'm actually as intrigued as everyone.
Well, so going back sort of from the end of karting to, well, my small career, if you like, someone my dad knew from racing a while back ran a small team in Derby, and he had this old Van Diemen Formula Ford 2000, which was probably a bit like a Formula Renault now or something like that. But it was 5 years old at the time, and it had been in an accident, and the chassis was all bent. So he bought it. It was a complete car, but just bent. So that was a little project for us to straighten that out, put it together, and said, well, we might as well, let's do a test day. So that's how I got into doing that. And I did a few races in the first couple of years. But again, we could never afford to do too much. And then got a bit more serious. It met Mike Pilbeam, who we'd known from BRM, and he ran obviously a successful hill climb cars, but he also built some Formula Ford 2000s, which were quite nice little cars.
Did he? I didn't know that.
Early 80s, really. Yeah. Unfortunately, it never quite took off for him, so he kept with the hill climbs because that was so successful. So we spent, myself and my friend who acted as my mechanic, Steve, we went to Pilbeam's for a couple of weeks, built up a car. We learned a hell of a lot in that time. We're in the factory with a great, their sort of main mechanic, Mick, who unfortunately is no longer with us anymore. And built up a car, and then it was at that point we started doing things properly, like made up a gauge to measure the bump steer of the car, which is just a little trellis that lent on a plate that you put on the wheel hub, but with a dial gauge on it, so you knew exactly where the bump steer was. I mean, on those cars they had more movement than some cars that we have now, so the bump steer is more important. But
I was going to say, I've got a question for you about bump steer.
Yeah.
So my background is racing, but it's also automotive, so mainstream automotive.
Yeah.
So
okay. Yeah.
The bump steer is a characteristic you're designing into the car on purpose. But with my own racing and in the paddock, the paddock folklore says you don't want any bump steer ever because it's bad. But no one really tells me why. And I was like, I'm not sure. Like, why would you not want to? So what's your perspective on that? And have you used it as a tuning aid and things like that?
Yeah, in car racing, it's especially something smaller like a Formula Ford or a Formula Ford 2000, something with a little bit more movement in it. It depends on the level of bump steer you've got, but if you work on a big level of it, if you hit the brakes hard and let's say you've got quite a lot of bump steer on the front, And as it squats down, the wheels are doing this as you're trying to modulate the brake, or the rear's doing that. It just can make...
No one can see this, but you're the hands are moving. Gareth's hands are pointing outwards at the moment. So just for the benefit of for people who can't see you, which is everyone.
From the steering wheel, you'll just feel it shaking a lot, and it doesn't give a lot of confidence on the brakes, and hence you'll probably brake a bit earlier or not as hard, and it won't lead into lap time. I know motor manufacturers tend to build bump steer into the rear of cars quite a lot to help with, depending on which geometry and kinematics they've got on the suspension on the rear, it can help on acceleration or for front wheel drive cars or rear wheel drive, it can be a bit different. So I think from an auto manufacturer point of view, that they can design a bit of bump steer in to make a car feel a bit safer, let's say, in certain areas of it. If,
Well, there's a stability question to it. And then there's also a compliance perspective. So when you go around the, and this is again something that never seems to get discussed in racing, but when you go around the corner, there's a lot of load on the tire. Well, and so it's going to turn, it's not going to stay the same. It's going to tow in or out.
Yeah.
It will do. So it's like, well, why don't we influence that a little bit and get it doing what we want it to do?
Yeah. So obviously on a road car, you've got all the rubber bushes and things to stop the horrible road noise. Well, that gives it compliance when you start pushing it a bit. So it makes more sense to try and build something around it. But with a more racy type car with rose joints and things, it's something you don't really want, because that makes everything feel every little bit then through the car, and anything like that can upset the balance makes it more difficult to drive.
So you've built a dial gauge, bump steer, measuring bit of kit, which sounded pretty cool. Yeah.
That's awesome. Just learnt about everything, and then use the pill beam for about a year. But the at that time the Reynard sort of came on and blew everyone's doors away, really. So we bought another couple of pill beams off Swallow Racing that were rolling chassis or had slight damage. They're all rolling chassis. So we built three rolling chassis complete with all the bits we had from the pill beams and made them nice. I got a bank loan. I went to the bank and said, I want to buy this car. I think I can get money. And I got a loan for, about £3,000 in 1984, I think. But I had no big income at the time. Myself and my friend Steve, who was also a mechanic, we did a mobile mechanics business, servicing taxis and things, just to make some money in between racing. So we'd done a mechanics course. That's how we met. We met at college doing a mechanics course. But so we had a mobile mechanics and then went racing when we could. So I had to convince the bank manager, as you did in those days, that I could get prize money to help pay. We were selling these cars. A Reynard was about 8,000 at the time or something like that. So the bank loan wasn't the whole amount. I was selling cars, I could win, and amazingly I got the loan, paying it back over 4 years. So with that, and we sold all the pill beams to a racing school person, I bought a second-hand Reynard, a year old Reynard, and I wanted to do a British Championship race at Silverstone but couldn't get in for a test day, so did the first race of the year, called a Marshalls race, which was a Formula Lib race, just to run it at the track.
Oh, okay.
And basically anything goes. There was cars, old Formula 5000s, old F2 cars, all sorts, F3 cars. I think there was about 30 cars on the grid, but I qualified second. It was a 3-2-3 grid. I qualified second to a 200 horsepower clubman's car at the time, and then got the lead off line and won it by a mile this race, so that was quite good. I won the first race for the Reynard, but then my main focus, because what we decided, we can't afford to do the British Championship properly. You can't afford new tyres every time and travelling all over the circuit, all over the country with hotels. We always slept in the van or in a tent. We never had hotels. So we said the Donington Championship at the time did mostly Donington Park. It was only about six or seven races. It went to Cadwell and Silverstone, but it was mainly around our area. So we said we can probably just about do that properly. Still can't have new tyres every time, but it's something we can do properly. So we've focused on that more, but I did like to do a couple of British races, and we did a couple of European races as well, just to, again, push yourself and get that experience. But in fact, the last race I did with a pill beam was Zolder, and it was the best qualifying I had. It was in the days when Gugelmann won the championship, and Donnelly, Bert Fabi, all those names from the past. And I had this, it was damp qualifying, and we had these really old wets, because that's the only wets we had, but I think they were just right for it. I qualified about 12th or 13th out of sort of 40-odd people. And then...
That's a proper track there as well.
It was a hell of a track. But unfortunately, on the last lap of quali, I went off around the back and ended up carted off to the medical centre and bent the car in two, so I couldn't make the race. So that was a bit disappointing. We went back there with the Reynard, and it was a wet race, and I came through. I finished about 12th, I think, which I was quite pleased with, because in the wet, the new tyre thing wasn't such an issue, whereas in the dry, you know, it can be 3 seconds a lap at those.
Do you do anything different in the wet? What tips have you got for people who are driving in the wet?
With most cars, really, any car, if it's very wet, let's talk about very wet, because obviously there's lots of different levels of wetness, but let's say...
it's so hard, this subject, isn't it? Right, just to take a moment. I get asked simple sounding questions all the time.
Yeah.
Right? All the time. And it's just like... And I want to give them a simple answer.
Yeah,
there isn't one. I'd be like, how can I still answer this and be helpful?
Yeah,
without sounding like I'm not answering the question. But you're right. I had this the other day. Right? It was like, well, what is wet? And I came up with a 5-point scale. So it's literally like, is it dry or is it biblical or is it somewhere in the middle? And it's different. What you do is different depending on your judgment of what this is.
If it's biblical, on most cars, you disconnect the rear anti-roll bar as a starting point, maybe the front one as well. It depends on what sort of car it is.
And why would you do that?
Again, just to soften the roll transfer from the one side to the other, so it's not... making it as peaky, so you've got more traction basically, and it just feels a bit nicer in the corners. If you disconnect the front one as well, biblical, it's probably okay. Anything less than biblical, then it can make the steering not quite as sharp, and you might want it on again. But whereas the rear roll bar disconnected probably lasts down to three of your stages before you get to that horrible greasy dry bit where you think, is it best to leave it in dry setup because I'm going to do more in the dry? I mean, sometimes in F2, you know you're going to start a race in the wet, but you can look at the pre-forecast and say, look, this is the end of the rain. In 10 laps, it's going to be dry. We're going to do most of this race in the dry, so you just put wets on with a dry setup because you know at your pit stop you're going to put slicks on and you'll make a hell of a lot more by doing that than trying to be clever early on and then ruin it, just be too soft when it's got slicks on. And another thing with wet is worth experimenting with, and you can find a lot of time, is tyre pressures, simple tyre pressures. And I'm not going to say you need these tyre pressures because every tyre is different. Whatever tyre you have,
I'm only laughing because this is just something that I'm spending my whole time talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever your stock tyres for whatever you're racing, experiment. Normally, for very wet, if we go back to biblical again, you go up on the tyre pressures to open up the channels on the tyres as much as possible and give you some support. As it gets drier, you start coming down on the pressures because you don't want the tyres to overheat and the pressures go. If you left the high pressures in and you're driving on a partly wet track, the temperatures just go through the roof and you've got no grip at all. So you just keep going from biblical 5 to your 1. You start high and just gradually keep coming down, depending where you are in that scale. And that works for most sort of tyres, but you've got to experiment really with your own your own manufacturer, let's say.
So the tips are rear anti-roll bar if you run one, or if you have that, which can help maybe shift the balance a little bit more towards the front wheel, more understood, a bit more stable. And then the other one is is your kind of tires, tire pressures, and then pump them up a bit.
Pump them up for very wet, and then if it's just a greasy day, you have them a bit lower than normal. So you've just got to find what that level is out for whatever tires you're running on. But that's something you can try on a track day or whatever, you know, start with high pressures and go with low pressures and see the difference.
Absolutely. And again, that circles back to what we talked about earlier in terms of the driver.
Yeah.
And what you'll feel. And that's worth, so it's a pressure sweep is a thing that, term that I've heard it called, but basically where you start high and you drop down a few steps and you can really try and feel the difference as a driver, both in the dry and then obviously in the wet as well.
Yeah, it works for both conditions really. It's probably more extreme in the wet. You'll feel a bigger difference than in the dry, but in the dry it's still a good thing to do because you might find whatever track you're at. Let's say you pump the pressures up. I don't know. I would say probably if you go up between 2 and 5 PSI from whatever is your standard and then do the same the other way, providing you've not got restricted tire pressures like some championships have now.
It's just so difficult, isn't it? It's just so difficult to be precise. I know I can tell you, like, I just want to give like a proper number, like give someone like a number to work with.
Yeah, it's hard to give a number because they're all so different.
Well, and the car weight is a big influence as well. So if you've got like a heavier car,
but to make a difference, I think let's say if your pressures are around 20 psi hot as a normal. To make a difference, you go 2 or 3 PSI from that to make a difference. And what you might find, whatever track you're at, it might not be the best thing for that track, but maybe in two corners on that track, it was very good, like two fast corners. So you think, well, if I go to a circuit with more of those sort of corners, that could be the way to do. So it starts giving you a little bit of info, really, that you can log down. And obviously make notes all the time when you've tried something and where it was better and where it was worse.
So with that, and because you mentioned at the beginning some tips and takeaways, I think you already like mentioned loads, because you said some things that are kind of free, you know, they're quite free and easy to do.
Just when you've got to look at, because there's plenty of things you can do that cost a fortune, but if you're looking at more the amateur or racer that hasn't got the big budget, there's still things you can do. I mean, again, on tyres, a good thing is don't just go there with whatever you've blown them up with. When you get to a track...
What is the gas, from a gas point of view?
Yeah. What air you've got in the tyres. Let them all out. We call it purging the tyres. Let all the air out as much as you can. If you can, fill it up with nitrogen. You know, get a bottle of nitrogen and fill it up, because... it's not the be-all and end-all. I know everyone says, oh, nitrogen this, nitrogen that. You're really trying to minimise the moisture in the tyre, and there can still be some in there when you purge it, because it can stay in around the edges. But that's what gives you the pressure increase, the moisture level in the tyre. So if you can minimise that, you'll have less pressure rise, and that again can help on over a course of a race. Rather than a qualifying, over the course of a race, really, if you can minimise the pressure. I mean, we do it quite a lot. If you can find somewhere that's got what they call a dry air compressor now, which a lot of places have got, then you can just pump them up with the normal dry air. You don't need a bottle. But even if you've only got a compressor in the back of your van, check it's not full of water.
Yeah.
And get that out of it. Yeah. But then... purge your tires a couple of times during the day and just put fresh air in and just try and minimize that moisture content in there.
I mean, if you do have a general, I've seen these things where you put it on to it sort of dries the air as you, how about they're like rice or something inside. I can't remember what they are inside, but
they take the moisture out of the air.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can get those machines, but obviously there is a cost involved with that, which is probably beyond most amateur racers, let's say. And the time factor as well, that you need Swan to do that for you, really, whilst you're running around doing all the other job.
And this is it, isn't it? This is the practicality. So we talk about this stuff all the time, and it's kind of like, well, this is, you know, and so I never say, like, this is what you should do.
No,
it's like, what I'm always trying to do is, like, this is a more professional approach, and it's up to you to decide if that's going to work for you as an individual. Data is another one, you know, that's much more commonly available now, but it's kind of like, is this for you? You know, it's still got to be fun for you. Your weekend still has to be fun when you're doing stuff. So the idea here is just to, like, introduce a lot of these professional approaches, and then people listening can kind of just cherry pick.
Yeah.
What they fancy doing, but it's still going to be enjoyable.
If you can get a cheap data system and just look at brake and throttle and G-force and steering, you can learn a lot from that. And again, it goes back to the experimentation. Try different brake shapes. I mean, we say a brake shape, we're sort of anal about them in things with carbon brakes, which is basically like a sail where you hit the brake and the pressure goes straight up and then you bleed it off. So it's like a triangle shape.
So brake shape, you mean the shape of the trains rather than the actual, the physical brake itself. It's like, which is, put those round brakes on, or the square ones, or these oblong ones. No, it's not that. No, it's the shape you see on the computer,
So which looks like a triangle if you get it nice. But but on some different sorts of cars with steel brakes and different pads, it can sometimes work better looking like a loaf of bread where you brake, then hold the pressure on a little bit and then bleed it off. And because the technical terms of mu for the friction can happen a bit later with some brakes. So again, you can try just braking differently on a session on a track day or whatever, and just see which one works best. If you've got a small data system, then you can start looking at those aspects. I mean, one thing name dropping a bit, but Lewis Hamilton.
You haven't done enough name dropping, by the way. People are listening, and they're like, "You see, who is this guy? Like, he's dropping in a few little hints here." I mean, like, I've got a little list here, right? So you say about name dropping, I've got a little list of some of the drivers that have passed through your hands, but who like, you do some name drop just for the sake of people listening, so they feel like, okay, so there's some of this stuff is, you know, these are well-known people, like I don't know, Scott Speed, Timo Glock, you know, all these people that have been in Formula One,
Ernie Viso, the Bruno Senna, Karen Chandup, the Sky Man.
Just goes on and on, doesn't it? It's just too humble. You're too humble. But go on, do the name dropping that you were gonna say.
And I think we were running, Oliver Turvey, who worked at McLaren at the time. We had a McLaren connection, if you like. We weren't a junior team, but F1 teams like to say they have connections with GP2 or F2 teams. But it can help, and it's nice going there, and it's nice the driver to go there and use a simulator, but generally you have a meeting with all the engineers and they say, well, you can do this or that, or why can't you do that? And you say, well, it's not, none of that's allowed in our rules. We can't change that to an aero. It might look crap, but you can't change it. So it generally falls apart like that, and they just like to offer you drivers so that they can take money off them to be a part of the junior program. But some have got proper things going. And we had an association with McLaren, and we had one of the engineers came with us for a few races to see, because he'd gone straight from uni into F1, as a lot of decent engineers do. But they wanted him to see something other than F1, so he did a few weekends with us. And He, at the time, it was Hamilton and Kovalainen, I think, were their drivers. And one thing that Lewis used to do quite a lot, which anyone can do on a track day or whatever you want, is some circuits require a different way of driving than other circuits, just because of the nature of the corners, you know, long corners or short Mickey Mouse type tracks. And what Lewis used to do with them, and I'm sure he still does now because he's very switched on in all that sort of thing. In his first session at the track, he'll do what's called a granny lap and a hooligan lap. So basically, you drive one lap trying to be as smooth as anything, you know, brake a little bit earlier, but get on the throttle earlier and be all your inputs nice and smooth. And then another lap, braking as late as you can, turning in, getting the tail out a bit, getting on the throttle. And then they look at the data afterwards and actually find out, well, at these three corners, the hooligan lap was actually better, and at the rest, the granny. So then you start getting an idea on the best way to drive, never mind doing anything with the car. And that's something anyone can try. It doesn't cost anything at all, you know, just a couple of sessions. And it can sometimes open your eyes a little bit, you know.
So one of the things that really has come out recently, I've been discussing more recently, is around this sort of more purposeful practice and more purposeful testing. Because quite often, like you've already alluded to it, like there's so much to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to get the car on the track.
Yeah.
You get the car and you sort of buckle up, put your helmet on, and you sort of breathe a sigh of relief. You know, it's like,
right, yeah.
We've made it. We've got to the end of the pit lane. We're about to go out on the track. It's like, And then it's a case of like, what are we actually going to do now? And you drive around, you look at the stopwatch, and you come back and you do some stuff with feeling, and it's like, oh, okay. And then retrospectively, you can often think, actually, you know, if I'd thought about that before, if I'd gone in on the front foot, maybe we'd have got more out of that session, or maybe we'd have found something different.
Well, definitely having a plan beforehand is good, and they're the things you can plan for. This session, I'm going to do five laps like a hooligan and five laps like a granny, and just see if it surprises me what I see on the lap times. And then,
but the interesting thing is, though, that you're talking about driving.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing to do.
Not engineering.
No. But
you see what I mean? So quite often, like when people think, oh, I'm going to plan my session.
Yeah, yeah.
They're thinking engineering things like, oh, I'm going to try to set up, or we've already talked about it, like pressure sweeps on the tires or different settings. But it's as valid.
Definitely.
To experiment with the driver. So it's like, right, we're not going to change anything. The car's going to be exactly the same as it was.
Yeah.
We want you to go, like a first session, for example. Right? A lot of people aren't, you know, they're not driving all the time.
Yeah.
And so it does take you a while to calibrate.
Yeah, get back into it.
Driving on track again. So that's just it. That's the objective for the session. We'll take all the data and the tire pressures and everything. But the goal for this session is just to dust the cobwebs off and get you back up to speed. And then in this case, you could try these experiments with some different lines or something like that. Just, but going in there on a positive,
Don't always drive around exactly the same way, because you're wasting time, and it can then help the engineering side. If the driver's found the best way, you can then help that by tweaking a roll bar or something to get the balance right at various corners. So it's important to not forget there's a human sat in there that sometimes you have to walk a bit, and don't say you do the same thing all the time until you get.
It's funny, we're doing. I was going to mention my course again, but I just it's a new thing for me, relatively. Now, we're working through it with people, and they're very, you know, it's quite a lot of the people, not all of them, are quite technically focused.
Yeah,
looking at all the different things that you can do, and one of the things that came across in this particular conversation that I was having was just that the driver was not being considered as a variable.
Mm.
And yet they are the most important variable.
Well, one thing that opened my eyes, because in single seater racing, you work with one driver in your car, and mainly for at least a season, you work with them intimately, and that driver might be a second off the pace averagely, and you pulling your hair out, or in my case, I've got a lot left, but you're trying to find every hundredth and tenth, you know, and sometimes you're kicking yourself because you must have lost something. But when I started doing the World Endurance quite late in my career, which I'd never looked at before, I'd never been that interested in, but my friend and former business partner Richard Selwyn got involved with the German team Project One and said they're only doing Super Cup at the time, and they've done that for years and won the championship, but they're going to do WEC. What do you think? That's a big step. And he said, yeah, they don't appreciate it yet, but I've tried to tell them. So they wanted me on board to try and bring that along a bit. So when I started with that, it was amazing. You've got three drivers then in exactly the same car, all of different, in the GTE AM it was in. So you've got a pro. In our case, we had Jörg Bergmeister, a very strong, successful Porsche pro, knew what he wanted. He was quite hard on us as engineers, but in the right way, if you know what I mean. Then we had a silver driver, Patrick Lindsay, the American, who had his own team. So he knew a lot about things, and he also thought he knew a lot about things, but maybe not so much. And then the bronze driver, Egidio Perfetti, who very good bronze driver. He's one of the, his family owns the Mentos Mint. A massive thing, and a lovely guy.
Keep them separated from Coca-Cola. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Exactly. We did say that to him a few times. A really nice guy, and he could turn a decent lap. But it was funny. You'd put the pro in first, and the car would do whatever it could do, and you'd try a couple of little things with him. But then you've got to get the drivers in to get their laps in. So then you'd perhaps get the gent in, and the car would be 3 seconds a lap slower or 2 seconds. And then the silver would go in and he'd be a second faster than that, but not. So you can see how important the driver is in the whole equation. That car hasn't changed, but there's probably 2 to 3 second difference between three drivers. So,
and how do you approach that though? So, because people listening are in the same position in that sense.
Yeah.
Well, they might be self-coaching themselves, or they might be in a team, and there's a, you know, motor racing by its nature has a bravado to it, I suppose. And there's a lot of paddock advice that goes on about, you know, I'm flat through turn three. It's easy. And you're thinking, I'm not flat through turn three. That's like, are you right? And it's all like smoke and mirrors, right? You know, well, there might be flat through turn three, but it's because I was so slow off the last corner. There's all these different reasons, right? But so how do you, have you done any coaching with drivers like that in that sense? Because you end up having to be a coach even if you're in.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's easier in that way, in a sense, because you've got the pros' data. You always let the pro drive it first. But as these things are with the balance of performance and everything, the manufacturers always like the pro to have a full load of fuel and if he's got new tires on, so you're not showing a lot, but you're still getting a decent data from him, and then you've got that to use when the silver and the bronze go in. So I mean, I had quite a good relationship with Perfetti, and I did all the radio comms and everything on track and the strategy and stuff, but I would be looking at the telemetry coming through and have one of Bergmeister's laps as the datum, and would be advising him during a stint, you know, you can brake later there, or during qualifying, you know, next lap you need to be flat through Rouge or whatever, you know, pump them up, tell him, you know, you've got the tires on, you've got the fuel load low, you can do it, sort of thing. And it's trying to get that relationship, really, which sometimes it doesn't happen with a driver, just different characters. You never get, you can have a working relationship, but you never get that intimate relationship. And I think when it does click with someone, it's very rewarding then, because every little thing you say, he believes, and vice versa, and you have a real good connection then. But you can still have a very good year with someone that you haven't really connected with, but it's not quite the same thing. But it's a two-way street in that respect, really.
I'm looking at the time. I can't believe it's all. We're already. I've been loving it. Really enjoying this conversation. I'm so pleased you're able to join us. If you were left us with one or two tips, I mean, you've already given us.
Yeah.
But if like one or two things that you've seen, in the paddocks or you've seen that go around you and you just sort of think, you know what, you know, it would be better if, you know, it would be good for people to maybe consider doing something that you've
I would say in the lower end regions of racing, don't be tempted to bolt something on your car or do something just because you've heard it in the paddock pub in the evening before. Have a good reason for doing anything. I mean, if you're allowed aero devices or things like that, you can do your own flow viz with a bit of WD-40 on there, and you might find.
Oh, really? I've never seen that.
Yeah. We did it on that A1GP thing. Someone wanted us to run the American thing, and we ran Scott Speed at Paul Ricard in a 3-day test, the first big test for it, actually. And those cars were a bit crude to start with, and they had this big wing on. And we did the WD-40 and found that the last two holes of wing were useless. The flow was just all over the place. So it was better to run two holes off foot maximum. And we ended up quickest on those 3 days. And it's little things like that. If you've got...
So how would you do it? How do you put it on? So you just like put a little bead at the front or something like that?
Spray it on.
You just spray it on.
And it'll pick little bits of dirt up, so you'll see the flow afterwards. But if you want to go a little bit deeper than that, you can use paraffin. And you can get a powder from aerodynamic places, which the F1 teams use, where you see all the fluorescent lines. You can get this powder and just mix it with paraffin. But you could mix something else with paraffin just to make it a white colour, even if you put a bit of water in it, or something that makes it go off. But generally, they'll pick dirt up along the way, and you can, if you know what you're looking for, you can see if the flow is going back on itself or just not looking nice. So that's another little thing you can do.
That's a good one.
But
thank you.
But definitely have a plan when you go anywhere, and perhaps plan a couple of sessions just driving differently, trying different lines, trying the granny and the hooligan, but also a plan on tire pressure sweep, roll bar sweep if you've got different positions on your roll bar, and even a ride height sweep if you can change the ride height on the car, because the attitude of the car, the rake of the car, has a big effect on the aerodynamics. And I mean, with some more professional stuff, you get the aero maps and you can have a good idea where it's got to run. But on a not so professional setup, you've got to find that out yourself, and you might find that running 10 mil higher on the rear, having more rake, yes, it'll roll a little bit more on the rear, but it'll be a lot more balanced because the aero is better. So that's another thing, you know, simple sort of thing you can do. So have a plan to do these things. That's the main thing, along with making sure the wheels are tight, making sure the fuel's in the car, and you've got...
Well, it goes full circle, doesn't it? All the way back to the beginning. Yeah. Like, when you just started with your, you know, 14-year-old with your cart, you know, have you screwed this thing together?
Exactly, yeah.
And then the tip for the cleaning is another one. That's another guest of mine who... He works in Mercedes, but he also hill climbs.
Okay, yeah.
So there's lots of parallels there, but that was his big tip. He's like, you know, the biggest thing you can do is clean your car. And I'm like, I'm looking at him going like, what? And I'm like, explain. He goes, yeah, because you're looking at the car.
Exactly, yeah.
And you're seeing stuff that you don't see.
No, if you're just polishing the exterior, you don't see anything. But if you're cleaning everything... I mean, you can like take the engine out and clean everything, and you might think, "Oh shit, that's cracked down there by engine or whatever." You know.
Yeah, obviously, this is treat with caution.
Because
you may not want to know.
Yeah, bring one together quickly and try and sell it.
Look, Gavin, thank you so much for this. It's been absolutely wonderful, and you know, I just really appreciate taking the time and thank you.
No problem. Been good fun.
How great to have Gavin share those insights with us on the show. A trait I often see in the most successful people in our sport is a humility and a willingness to share what they have learned and continue to learn to go faster and have more fun at the track. It was a real privilege to speak to him, and I hope you enjoyed hearing what he has to say as much as I did in talking to him. You may know that at the end of season one, I wrote the Motorsports Playbook, a summary distilling the first 20 shows into nuggets of wisdom. I made the notes so that you don't have to. If you've not got it yet, go and grab yourself a copy from the website. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and visit us at yourdatadriven.com.